didn't, like, Elrond's sons come to Helm's Deep?
I'm not sure.
I think I remember hearing that. No, that, and, like, is,
that, is,
commentary
that is touched on in the director's writing commentary.
Yeah.
The Elrond, and this is...
But it's so much better that it's the Lorien elves. Right. It really is. And, I mean, even though it was, it's just such a great moment.
And I like how they portray them, you know, like, you know, well-trained infantry.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess artillery is good.
And it's just a brilliant reworking of the Lothlorien theme by Howard Shore as a choral work.
That, the boy with Aragorn at that scene we talked over, that was Philip O'Boyne's son, was it not?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Is that lady?
Yeah, she's the third screenwriter.
Gotcha.
She's the one you see all over the extras because Fran Walsh is sort of the silent partner of the three, or between her and Peter Jackson.
But we finally did see her for the first time this year.
At the Globes.
At the Golden Globes.
Yeah.
Wasn't Peter hooking up with her? Who was he hooking up with?
Fran Walsh is...
Fran Walsh is...
Yeah.
Fran Walsh is...
Phil Boyens is a friend of theirs. Yeah. And she's actually working on King Kong with them, too.
Yeah.
But again, you know, it's all so true to his character. That's why... That's what I love about... that element of this particular movie is that, I mean, his comedy is so true to his character. And I believe it was John Rhys-Davies who says in the cast commentary that in his mind, or at least in... Or he, the way he approached Gimli's character is that Gimli doesn't think he's small. Gimli doesn't... You know, to some degree, he doesn't believe that he's, like, you know, 2.5 feet tall. You know, Gimli believes that he's just as tall as the rest of the characters.
Right. And I'm not sure if that's a...
Okay,
you know,
here it is.
That's almost a typical dwarf thing that you see. Mm-hmm. In
okay, page 521 of the trilogy.
Gotcha. Book.
Oh,
shit. You just lost.
Anduril, cried Aragorn, Anduril of the Dúnedain. Charging from the side, they hurled themselves upon the wild men, and I should say that Éomer is actually at Helm's Deep in the book. Anduril rose and fell, gleaming with white fire. Shout went up from wall and tower, Anduril. Anduril goes toward the blade that was broken, shines again.
Ooh.
So...
Good little reference there, Brian.
Yep.
Now, this was not an element in the book, was it not?
What?
The families in the...
Well, you never heard about them, but they did go into the mines.
Yeah.
They did go into the mines, but, I mean, there wasn't, you know... How do you break away from the battle in a book to, you know, show that?
So see, it makes the battle here so much more emotional.
Yeah.
It makes it work on that level so much better than it could have. It's just a straight action sequence.
Yeah.
And, yeah, this is some of the more interesting DVD extras is the piecing together of this battle.
Yeah.
And just... The number of nights it took just to film it, and all the things that the extras endured, and I mean just the stories are just. Just that is the reason I'm the DVD nuts that I am.
Mm-hmm.
It's just because I eat that stuff up. I absolutely love that.
Well, they make it so interesting compared to some DVDs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a good reason these are kind of the gold standard of the medium now.
Well, you know, we were just going to turn around, but, you know, since you killed one of our guys, I think we're going to...
Now you have the march of that Lorien theme, which didn't take me until one day I was listening to it, like, wash the Two Tower soundtrack, washing dishes, and they've got the Lorien theme on here from, you know, when Galadriel was speaking. Then I heard the Hornburg track, which is basically the Helm's Deep music, and I heard this, and I'm like, oh my god, this is the Lorien theme.
Now, you know, we got to see two really extremely cool things in 2002, and one was getting to listen to Yoda give battle orders in backwards Yoda talk, and then the other one was getting to listen to Aragorn give battle orders in Elvish. And I've always debated between the two, which was, I don't know, which I thought was neater. I don't know.
As a lifelong Star Wars fan, I would say Yoda.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as sheer intensity, Aragorn.
Oh yeah, without question.
Now this basically follows the book to a T.
Right.
I mean, I remember, like I said, I raced through this chapter of the book because of the fact I could not put this down. Such an engrossing read. I mean, it really just flies. And, I mean, there's that clack scream that you hear in just about every action movie. But, yeah, I mean, there are so many great things as far as this movie, this trilogy as an adaptation, and this is one of the best. I love that they added a little more of the sort of contest between Legolas and Gimli, because that is a fun part of the book, this chapter.
Winner of the MTV Movie Award for Best Action Sequence.
That scene is just jaw-dropping. I mean, just amazing.
Just great.
Now, if I remember the book correctly, it doesn't take that much to get them to agree, does it?
I mean,
to go
I
to
think
war.
A bit less back and forth.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I don't remember. I mean, I don't remember necessarily them saying after the end move we'll go to war, but I don't necessarily remember being that hard for them to convince the Ents to go to war.
So, Dave, your thoughts on this scene?
I mean, there's just not a whole lot to say.
We just said it. it was earlier. There's not too much more to say.
Yeah.
This is my favorite gag. This is probably my favorite gag in the movie, is hearing Gimli count. Never
realize
as like they pan away. And there's so many good gags in this movie, but that's probably my favorite one. And, you know, we were discussing in the episode one batch, the episode one commentary, that, you know the battle sequences in the new trilogy versus the battle sequences in the original trilogy, you know, and which ones really made you feel like you'd actually been through honest to God conflict.
Yeah.
And this one feels so real.
Right.
And
yeah,
you know, you really do feel as if you've been through a very emotional, you know, a very real conflict. It was both emotional and physical.
Well,
and
I think part of it is the fact that it...
And it was very real. You know.
I think part of it is that you get the feeling, you know, at one point that's like, okay, the tide is turning in their favor, and, you know, it looks mm-hmm. like they could actually pull out. And then something worse comes along.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, same thing. And then, oh, well, it looks like we might have been able to do this. And then something worse comes along. And
such as?
Yeah. So.
Which, that is a beautiful miniature shot. The,
yeah, it is.
The wall exploding the way it does. I mean,
and I love the expression on Theoden's
face. Yeah, exactly.
You know, that confident cockiness he had before is just, like, in horror now.
And what is so incredibly frightening about these... About the Uruk-hai is that, you know, they're born with but with one purpose.
Yeah.
You know, and that's to, I mean, that's what makes it, that makes them so, I mean, so realistic and so frightening to me. Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it's their numbers that's what, you know, really gets the enemy, not necessarily the fighting ability.
Yeah.
You know, you see them just wasting their own men all over.
Yeah, no kidding,
There's more and more just coming, you know. Point
blank
range,
yeah. It's a great sort of POV shot too. Mm-hmm. The arrows, reminiscent of the one in Fellowship of the Ring, and actually a shot that's coming up, which I just love. Ooh yeah.
Oh,
if it wasn't cool enough, that it was sliding down a staircase
right.
on a shield.
Right.
He uses the shield to decapitate
another guy.
Orc, and while shooting.
Right.
Yeah,
I remember just cheers watching that for the first time.
I remember just getting a kick out of it, seeing it in the previews. It's like, oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
I like the designs of the Ents.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, not just Treebeard, but I mean all of them.
Reminiscent of like different types of people that you see out there, kind of similar.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, though. I mean, that's what makes them special is that they're all different. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not the way they are in, you know, the animated version. You know, they're not all just trees. They're just they all have their own distinct physical characteristics.
I should say that the animated version of the Ralph Bakshi film only goes through like half of Two Towers.
Oh, yeah.
It goes up until Helm's Deep and the March on Isengard and the Fellowship one. Yeah. I can't remember where exactly it gets up to with the Frodo, Sam, and Gollum thing. It just does, but it doesn't go that far. But
so we don't see the Battle of Helm's Deep.
You see the Battle of Helm's Deep, okay. Yeah. Okay. But, because that's basically where the movie ends.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But, no, they never were able to. So we, up until this movie, we actually never saw the second half of the Two Towers.
Yeah.
So, on screen. And actually, I was going to tell you guys that I was going through some of my old videotapes and stuff. You will never guess what I found that I had on tape. The Rankin Bass animated versions of The Hobbit and Return of the King.
Huh.
Yeah.
I almost might want to borrow those from you just to like. Just
well, they're on the same tape, so you wouldn't have too much of a problem.
I would just want to borrow that just because, I mean, I've heard you talking about them so much.
More Return of the King than The Hobbit.
Right. But yeah, I mean, just and then to listen to the you know, the various commentaries on the DVD, you know, make comparisons that they did. I mean, I just want to see these things out of pure morbid curiosity, just to see just how ridiculous they really are.
Well, in The Hobbit's defense, I will say that's actually very close to the story in the book.
Yeah, the animated version of The Hobbit is probably.
I mean, they really messed up the look of Gollum, in my opinion. But I mean, and that's like a.
I remember what you're saying about the animated version of Return of the King, is that they really got the look of Gollum right.
No, that was the animated version of Lord of the Rings.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Because The Hobbit and Return of the King were done by the same company, mm-hmm. and they did Gollum the same way. It was the Ralph Bakshi one that I felt got the Gollum look right,
mm-hmm.
or at least closer. But, no, The Hobbit, they actually did a pretty good job staying faithful to the story. Return of the King, they just massacre, more or less.
Well, I mean, what did you tell me about it? Like, they had Uruk-hai breaking
orcs.
And singing orcs, and I'm like...
Singing orcs.
Yeah. That's all you need to know, folks. Singing orcs.
And actually, another thing, they basically give away the ending with the beginning of the movie. Plus, because of the fact that you never saw the second half of Two Towers on screen until these movies, I mean, you just have no context as to what's going on. So, and the voiceover doesn't help at all.
Well, that's the thing. I've been trying to start reading The Hobbit.
Yeah.
Just because, I mean... There's been a really funny running gag with the three of us. You know, I would start to ask you guys questions, and you know, you would just say, "Read the damn book." You know, that's been something that's been really funny that's been going on between the three of us. You know, and you know, but what you've been, one of the specifics you've been giving me is that, you know, don't start the trilogy until you've read The Hobbit.
Yeah, don't make this mistake I made.
Yeah. And a couple other people I know made that mistake as well. Mm-hmm. They read the trilogy and then they read The Hobbit, which...
Yeah, I mean, I read The Hobbit 4 or 5 times before I touched the rest of the trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
I love that use of the Fellowship theme. I love that sequence. Mm-hmm. I love that bit.
Is that a marijuana leaf on Gimli's...
Something would tell me no. Yeah. These are some big ass ladders here.
Da 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 da.
One of my favorite shots of the entire trilogy is coming up.
Mine too, but it's not the same one as yours. I know you and Dave are really crazy about this shot coming up right here. It's pretty spectacular.
Yeah, that is pretty
cool. Damn.
Yeah, that's like... And just the way there's no, you know, there's no music, and just it's great. I mean, I really do appreciate that, but I just like this other shot coming up with Gimli and Aragorn. It's enthralling and it's heroic and not just this.
It's also kind of reminiscent of an Indiana Jones movie, actually.
Some man broke his leg doing that.
Yeah,
I love that shot. That and the one with Mary Pippin and Treebeard and the orc at the beginning is my two favorite images from this movie.
The thing that Harry Knowles, when he did his review of this movie, that I didn't really see the first time I saw the movie, but really understood when I was watching the movie again and again, is that he points out that in intercutting the stories, you have the shared highs and lows of the Fellowship in their own stories. Mm-hmm. Like, each story, when they intercut from one to the other, is at the same place emotionally.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, you know, you have the despair of the defeats at Helm's Deep. You have, you know, Merry and Pippin unable to convince Treebeard to, you know, Frodo and Sammy taking to Osgiliath. And, you know, then you have the highs at the end of the movie, which is also part of the reason why I don't think they could have ended the movie with Shelob as the book does, in that you have the victory at Helm's Deep, you have Faramir letting the hobbits go, and then you have the fall of Isengard.
Which, if I'm not mistaken,
and something you really feel in the Return of the King as well.
Wasn't Isengard in the books mostly explained through flashbacks?
It was explained through flashbacks.
Yeah.
Which,
I think I just need to read the damn book.
Yeah, I think you really do. We see a little bit of something new in this shot where we see Minas Tirith in the background, which they didn't do in the theatrical version. Yeah, the reason being that, you know, they were afraid people might think that was Helm's Deep and sort of confuse the geography. This is one of my favorite pieces of dialogue coming up right here with Treebeard. I mean, it's one of my favorite pieces of dialogue in general, because it's an oddly moving line. That piece of
Yeah. I mean, it's good.
I love that line because of the fact that it really brings it home to Treebeard, and you know, you sort of feel that feeling.
Well, I remember you discussing this line with me when this movie was first released, you know, and just the comparison between, you know, how a line like that would have been handled by a lesser director.
Yeah, that was actually something that I wrote when I did my top 10 list, and where Two Towers was number 4 on the list. And that thing, that little bit of dialogue, they have business with Yorks. That sort of goes back to something that I remember from Helm's Deep in the book that they didn't touch on, which is the fact that the trees make their way to Helm's Deep and basically help in the cleanup. Which they do put back in the movie here.
My favorite piece of music right here.
Yeah, I know you love this, and it's a great
my
piece
favorite
of music.
Piece, this is my favorite cue in the entire movie. I get such a buzz off of this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it really does what it's supposed to do. It signals the turn of the tide and
absolutely
the battles. You know, I'm just continuously blown away by some of the images we've seen in these movies, and this one in particular.
And, you know, we were talking about the use of inventive imagery in Fellowship. And the more I think about it, there is a great deal of it in this one.
Yeah.
But it actually feels very much under the radar in this one for some reason. And
yeah.
I remember I think it was Elijah Wood or Sean Astin saying in the cast commentary that they felt as if this one in particular felt less like a fantasy movie.
Yeah.
Right.
Just because you were so engrossed in the story.
There's a lot of heavy character interaction going. There's a lot of storylines happening. So, I mean, you know, it's hard to...
Who was it? Sean Astin's father?
Who worked with
Peter Jackson
on the
Frighteners.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Sean Astin mentioned that. That's part of the reason he wanted to work on this, was hearing his father talk about working with Peter on the Frighteners. So see, there is a good thing about the Frighteners, besides Danny Elfman's score and the visual effects.
Mm-hmm.
And
a little bit of Michael
J. Fox.
Yeah. It was all done with the miniatures.
Yep.
I was actually kind of in awe of that because it looked so much like a computer generated shot.
Yeah.
Or you just assume they would use the computer generation.
Well, they could have. I mean, give themselves a hell of a lot of time.
Right.
But no, they decided to do it the hard way, resulting in a much better film.
Well, that is just what you don't see enough of anymore, is the use of miniatures and, you know, more realistic photography. I mean, there's just
it's so much cheaper to do it on.
Oh,
I'm sure it is.
I mean, and the thing is, it's like you start seeing CG being used in films like Bad Boys 2, and it's like, why?
But I mean, sometimes CG is up to snuff, and sometimes it's not, and sometimes it is, but you know, they can't even pay for the amount of CG that they need to look real, you know, so they can't pay for the miniatures, and they can't pay for enough CG, you know, so they have to get the guy on his computer to throw something together, you know, and that's what we got.
Yeah.
But they can do it and make it almost look real in the context of a fast action movie, that, you know, it's kind of okay.
Yeah.
Unless you know what to look for.
I mean, the thing is, it's like, you know, it's like, when it comes to those movies, it's like, give me the days of, like, the original Lethal Weapon movies, and, you know, give me directors who are going to, you know, who go to the pains of actually building stuff, and I mean, you know, minimize CG, and I mean, Richard Donner's an excellent example of that, because he just did Timeline, which... admittedly, it's a kind of cheesy fantasy film,
right.
But it's still fun, and it's fun to watch from a movie fan standpoint, partly because I've been a huge Richard Donner fan for a while, but also because of the fact that he does it old school, and very few, and newer directors just don't do it. And it's like, they don't put the time in. Which is one of the reasons, I mean, for what it's worth, I still consider Richard Donner one of the more underrated filmmakers. In case you forgot what Gandalf said.
After, what, 3.5 hours?
Yeah, really. I mean, how could he not forget? I remember reading this part of the book and, you know, the horns at Helm's Deep. I just remember thinking, okay, whatever they do has to put the fear of God into an orc.
Yeah.
And it's like, the sound that they use for it is completely it.
Some brave dudes.
Yeah. Actually, I don't know if that one is my favorite shot of the movie. It might still be coming up now that I think about it.
What, this one?
No, not this one, although this is definitely a candidate. Mm-hmm. I remember there being cheers for some we saw this, watching that sequence. But, no, it's still coming up.
Oh, I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. We're sorry we're not talking, but...
Yeah, this is just such a wonderful moment. Ooh, yeah. I love the way they use this vocal,
right there.
the boy's vocal, mm-hmm. And I believe it's the same singer who does that high, you know, sorrowful music after Gandalf falls in Moria.
You know, he does
a little bit in Return of the King too,
and
another equally significant scene with Gandalf.
Well, he does that great song that's on the soundtrack,
yeah,
In Dreams.
Fellowship of the Ring.
Yeah, I mean, just...
But yeah, that scene where it's like near vertical and you see the horses just going down. That's probably my favorite scene.
That's a fantastic scene.
Shot of the movie.
Okay, Howard Shore, whenever you're ready to put out that CD.
Just anytime.
Just anytime now.
I'll make room in my budget for it.
Yeah.
Nine discs.
I only have 6 discs on my CD player. That's gonna be a bit of a problem.
And you can only listen to one disc at a time, so it's like just put one in one day and then just basically go through the entire thing. It will take you about 2 weeks to... probably a little bit... Like a week to go through all of them.
That's gonna hurt.
Yeah.
I mean...
painful right there.
I mean, now we're just watching.
Yeah. I mean, what can you say? I mean, other than just, wow. And that doesn't even do it justice. Just jaw-dropped awe is about the only thing that does it justice.
Yeah, I mean, I was wondering how they were going to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because, I mean, at first I was wondering how are they going to do the Ents period, and now, you know, we have the Ents fighting. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, how do you do the fall of Isengard?
Yeah,
I mean...
Even more amazing, you know, how would you even do that? But I can honestly say that I never really thought of any of this.
Yeah.
Never really thought of any of this. And if I ever really get successful at that.
Yeah.
that got laughing at.
Yeah, it did. Here you can kind of tell some of its miniatures and stuff.
Oh, it's a great
still
melding of the two. It's,
yeah. And the waters, I mean,
well, the waters
if it's
are
not
real
actually
element.
Real,
yeah.
It's very well simulated.
Mm-hmm. Now go back to Psycho Boy. He's like gone right now.
Yeah.
Which is not overused. I mean, that's not
no.
overused. Every place is used.
Yeah.
remember in the Two Towers video game, at one point you play Sam, you're trying to protect Frodo and Osgiliath, and if you lose, this guy just picks Frodo up and just carries him off.
Really?
Yeah.
That's nasty.
Yeah, it is.
You know what happens after that.
Closest I've ever come to really breaking down, you know, while watching these movies is probably right here. I mean, I was just totally, absolutely.
I mean, you know, you, by this point, you connected the characters so much that, you know,
yeah,
that right there is just insane.
Yeah.
You can't even believe that.
I mean.
You did not see that coming.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, is this part in the book?
Well, no, I mean, this entire thing is...
No, obviously, no, Osgiliath.
I mean...
That was such a stupid question. No, it isn't, is it?
Yeah, this entire thing in Osgiliath isn't even in the book, so... But, I mean...
And this is a beautiful cue right here.
Yeah, it is.
Because, I mean, you're just watching the... You're looking at the scale of everything, and the cue is so emotional. The scale of what's on the screen, the imagery, and then...
And the thing about Frodo here, and this is part of the reason why I don't think Elijah Wood's ever gotten the credit he deserves, is this is just so... This is not the Frodo we saw in Fellowship.
Right.
I mean, this is a complete change. I mean, if... In Fellowship, Frodo was, you know, he really, trying to describe how he plays the character in Fellowship, but in Two Towers, I mean, for most of the movie, he's just on the brink of just absolute terror. But, In this movie, he's just playing it complete despair. I mean, he's in that scene where he's ready to just give up and give himself over to the wraiths. I mean, it's just he's at the end of his rope at that point. The only thing that keeps him going is Sam, and I mean, it's something that's continued and even further.
Return of the King?
Yeah, but I'm trying to think of Enforce in Return of the King. But, I mean, you know, and the thing is, it's like, this is where you really, you know, it's like the end of Fellowship, where you have Sam going, I made a promise, you know, don't leave him, and I don't mean to. And I mean, this is the reinforcement of that promise.
And, you know, this does not feel, you know, like the word I'm not going to use here, you know, where it just does feel that way in the third movie. But, you know, again, we're not going to go there until we're talking about the third movie.
So yeah, this is the part of the in the book that we didn't get to see. Yeah. The trees that weren't there before are there
now. Yeah.
And
basically going
to work over the rest of the work on it.
That's
pretty messed up right there.
Yeah, it is.
That's pretty scary.
Still doesn't love you, but likes you as a friend.
It's not you, it's me. Good We got the privilege of getting to see the extended version in the theaters not too long ago. Of the first two movies.
As part of that, you know, gratuitous promotional tool for Return of the King, as if they needed another one.
Mm-hmm. And I remember this moment just getting a huge reaction. Which I don't know if you could have gotten away with that with the theatrical version, but...
No.
There was meant to be more Isengard stuff in the original version of Two Towers, but it was decided that it was placed better in the beginning of Return of the King, was it not?
Yeah, that's correct. And then they ended up cutting half of it out of Return of the King, the theatrical version.
But we'll most definitely see it in the DVD.
Oh yeah,
extended. Which you see in the Lombon Leaf, which you see in the theatrical version of Return of the King, but you don't see in the theatrical version of Two Towers.
Yeah. Well, it's the same thing as what happened with the gift-giving scene. You know, you saw the Limbus brand, the cloaks, and all of that stuff being given to them in the extended edition of Fellowship, but you saw it in the...
Yeah, the Elven
theatrical Rogue version in Two Towers.
I don't know, for some reason that just strikes me as a marijuana joke, but I don't know. So this is where we start to acknowledge the pending doom that is Sheila.
Yeah.
Is it not?
Well, not quite yet.
Well,
not quite yet.
The great evil or whatever, there's a...
Yeah. I mean, they do talk about Kira Thungle and the...
Right. But I mean,
they don't mention Sheila until... Well... The first...
My boy takes his abuse.
Yeah.
Isn't that what that is?
I guess,
care?
Farmer knows this boy is not up to any good.
So, yeah, I mean... The theatrical version of this particular film, this particular chapter, just feels more full circle. I feel as if, you know, rather than this. I mean, this version does give you more to chew on, but I don't know. I actually walk away from the theatrical version feeling a little bit more satisfied. I do start, as entertaining as I find a director's cut of a really good film, you know, I do start to feel a little bit of a little bit of it beginning to wear a little thin. I don't know why.
Well, I mean, it also depends on how well done the director, quote-unquote director's cut is. I mean, there are some director's cut that are infinitely superior to even a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm thinking about, obviously, the extended editions of these, and actually the other one that I would consider pretty great is the Almost Famous director's cut, too.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, there are some that are, you know, I would say are not as good as the originals.
I still get a kick out of watching this every time. From a movie lover's perspective, you know, if I see a great movie, I mean, I want to know everything there is to learn about it, and I want to know anything I can get my hands on about,
yeah.
As far as, like, you know, the making of the movie, what was left out, for what reason it was left out, you know. I don't know. I mean, I still eat this up every time mm-hmm. I view it, but at the same time, I mean, I feel more satisfied. I've told you, Brian, that, you know, the extended version of Fellowship is, in my opinion, superior to the theatrical version.
Yeah, I know.
But, you know, in this case, it does start, I do start to feel a little bit of, you know, well, battle fatigue, you know, just as if, like, you know, it feels as if it begins to wear a little thin. But, I mean, you know, I'm not trying to discredit this movie in any way.
Oh, I know.
I'm not trying to discredit the director's cut in any way.
Yeah.
It just, I don't mean to sound lazy or anything like that, or as if I'm, like, appreciate it any less.
Oh, I know. I know.
I do like the note that this chapter ends on.
Yeah, and that was another thing I was really worried about, because of the fact that it's like, well, God, it's like, if you don't have Shelob in there, it's like, how do you end it on that note of uncertainty?
And this is the place in the book where I thought they were, you know, where I hoped they were going to end it, and they actually turned out they ended it right there, too.
Yeah.
So I was pretty...
Yeah, they ended on just the right thing, where you get the potential... You sort of get the feeling of something worse coming, but you don't, you know, unless you've read the book, you don't necessarily know what. And
right.
It's like, I remember being so excited when they ended it this way, because of the fact that, I mean, that made up for any problems I had with the movie,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And then this final image,
mm-hmm.
with you know, this incredibly emotional cue that leads you into Gollum's song,
yeah,
is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, such a different image than the one that Fellowship.
Yeah.
I mean.
This is just a beautiful song, Gollum song.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really is one of my favorite. I mean, all three of the songs for the trailer are among my favorites ever, as far as movie songs go, but. I mean, this one is just... I was really disappointed when this one didn't get nominated for original song.
Well, how many total was Two Towers nominated?
Six.
Six. That's what I thought it was.
It was about less than half of Fellowship. And it only won for visual effects and sound editing.
You want to start those out, man?
Well, let's start with Dave. I mean, I pretty much have, you know...
So let's start with pretty much.
Okay.
We're gonna be here for a little while. Go ahead, Rob.
I figure let's go me, Dave, and Brian.
Okay.
But
so,
go. You know, I pretty much have said what have spoken my piece about this throughout our little discussion here. You know, it's still a fantastic chapter, and I mean, I'm usually a pretty big supporter of middle chapters of trilogies. You know, it goes back to Empire Strikes Back. You know, I even kind of like Reloaded. You know, for what it's worth. You know, I mean, more than you guys did anyway. You know, I just think middle chapters are so interesting to look at and analyze and, you know, break down, because, you know, it's the make or break of a trilogy, really, in my opinion, a middle chapter, just because it's either gonna hold your interest and make you want to know what happens to the characters when the story comes full circle, or you're gonna absolutely just lose interest in the story altogether. And
yeah.
That's why I love a good, you know, middle chapter of a trilogy, and this one holds up, you know, in spades.
Yeah.
So, Dave?
I mean, you know, when I watch all these movies, I'm constantly thinking of sort of the, you know, since I do read a lot of fantasy novels, do think about, you know, sort of the effect that these stories have had on, you know, other authors and other writing. And I mean, the parallels between some of the major ones like Dragonlance and Wheel of Time are just, you know, I mean, just you can't even count them, you know, from names to places to everything else. And so, you know, it's almost as if Tolkien has started, you know, sort of a whole new generation of fantasy authoring, you know.
Yeah.
So that's pretty amazing. And, you know, for like, you know, Harry Potter, I always stress this, you know, you gotta read the book if you want to get the true story. But even though some of these are sort of deviants from the book, I really say that, you know, watching the movie may just be enough for
yeah.
these stories, which I almost never say.
Yeah,
you know, but
it's especially hard to say for this.
Yeah, but in this case, you know, I mean, they do such a good job of capturing, if not the letter, then the spirit of the books that,
uh-huh.
You know, you almost don't even need to read the books. I mean, you know, Tolkien purists, yes, but in this case, I mean, I am sort of, you know, on the fence whether or not you even need to read the books after you watch this movie. They're that good, they're that well done.
Yeah.
You know, they capture that much of the book, so... Of course, you get another good chapter in the overall trilogy, and I really enjoy it. Brian?
I'm not saying anything.
Okay, good.
I'm shutting
off.
Okay. All right.
I've been sort of racking my brain about this past couple of days. I've been trying to think of what are my closing statements for this movie. I mean, I talked about, you know, some of the genres that this is a part of, and, you know, the most personal aspect about it that I felt, you know, in my closing statements of Fellowship. Got some other statements I want to talk about, but I was going to wait until Return of the King. And Ron actually touched on one of the things I was concerning, which is the ideas of sequels and middle chapters and what have you. I mean, it
does
really does.
Thunder, Brian?
Well, really does not. No, no, not at all. I'm trying to think, but it's like there's a whole. I mean, you guys basically.
I mean, after 4 hours of commentary, you know, well,
it's hard to believe.
What can you say?
I mean, it really is hard to believe. I mean, it's. You know, it's was one of the best films of its year. It's one collectively with 1 and 3, or even on its own, it's one of the best films of the past 10 years. It's going to be, and it's one of the greatest films of all time. I mean, it's it's both inspired by what's come before it, and it's without question going to inspire what comes after it. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I look at this film, and I look at all three films, and I look at this film, and I just think about the amazing amount of imagination that this movie has, that all of these movies have, that Peter Jackson has. I mean, you know, and I said earlier that it's like you think about the films Peter Jackson made earlier in his career, Bad Taste, Meet the Feebles, Dead Alive, The Frighteners, and Heavenly Creatures, and how those really make him a natural for this. It's absolutely true. I mean, you know, are they all great movies? No, of course not. I mean, I would never call Bad Taste even a good movie, or, you know, Dead Alive I think is a bit overrated, and, you know, but they all have one thing in common, and they have imagination. And Peter Jackson and these films, in addition to the ones that he made before, are make Peter Jackson an honest-to-God visionary. I mean, along the lines of Lucas, or Spielberg, or Tim Burton, or, you know, any filmmaker who's dared to tell a big story and tell it with this degree of audacity. And it's one of the reasons I just cannot wait to see what he does with King Kong, which I got a chance to see last year for the first time in a while. And I mean, the original still holds up as one of the greatest films ever made. And to think of, and that's that same audacity that I have been saying during these comments about Peter Jackson is the same audacity, the same visionary excitement that you attribute to the original King Kong, and you can really see in that film why Peter Jackson became a filmmaker, and I can't wait to see him bring it to life in his own way, seeing what he's done with this. So I think that's about it for me. I guess I did have some things to say after all. It was sort of stuff that I had said earlier, but stuff I still believe when it comes to this movie. So I'm Brian Scuttle.
I'm Ronnie Haynes.
And this is Yahoo's.